This break is brought to you by The Marine Biology Trip, an evidence for faith adventure in science and the Bible in the Florida Keys for ages 14 and up. Here's what a past student had to say.
And it's an educational hands-on experience that you will never forget. It's gonna stick with you. And you learn things that you probably wouldn't have learned in normal school. It's not what I expected to come here, but it exceeded my expectations of what it would be like. Because I thought it would just be like, okay, we do some homework, we snorkel, bam, done. You know, we see some fish. But like, we got to see some really cool stuff, and I've formed a lot of cool friendships that I probably never would have without the trip.
Find out more about this adventure by clicking the link in the description or go to evidenceforfaith.org/marinebiology. That's evidence, the number 4, faith.org/marinebiology.
A few weeks back, as I was preparing for these night sessions in my study, Charlotte was, if you don't know, Charlotte works, the recording studio for Evidence for Faith is in our house. So Charlotte lives just 1 mile from our house. And so she comes over and she works, her office space is inside the recording studio. So she's on one side of the house, I'm on the other side of the house, and Denise has her room, the kitchen. And so basically that's where the three of us spend our days when we're like that. Well, I was sitting in my study. I don't remember what I was actually, exactly where I was at with this, but I was researching something, and Charlotte came walking in to ask me a question about, I have no idea what it was, but she asked me a question, and she happened to look at the computer monitor that I had up, and she says, "Why are you reading about law and evidence for courts?" And I said, "It has to do with the session I'm doing." See, what I did is I wanted to find out what is actually in the court system today, what makes things legal, what can be presented as evidence, the importance of evidence in any case that decides the case. And I found out, I did not know this, but I found out that I just went through basic things in lawyer, like 101 classes, as I was reading through all sorts of stuff in textbooks online about this. And I found out that there's primarily 4 types of proof that is allowed in a court case. Now, one of which is digital. Well, the Bible was not written in the digital age. That's not going to help us much. We're not going to see a CD or have a DVD of Peter preaching a sermon at Pentecost or Paul at Mars Hill. You're just not going to see that. So the digital one we're going to set aside for right now because that's more of a modern thing. But the other three, there's physical evidence where there is tangible items left at a crime scene or something like that. That is physical evidence. It could be fingerprints or blood, DNA, things like that. There's physical evidence that's there. A second type of evidence that is allowed in court is documentary evidence. Documentary evidence is stuff that is written. If a person is going to perform a crime, and we see this once in a while, somebody will sit down and on the computer they'll type something, or they will handwrite a note out and then sign it, then go off and do some devious act. That paper now becomes submitted as proof, and it supports evidence, and so it can be used. So printed or written material like that can be used. A third part that we have in the court system that is allowed for proof is a testimonial, an eyewitness, statements made by people who actually saw the events. As I was sitting there studying this, I don't know why, I guess I was God just guiding me through and putting this together, but for the first time ever, it really dawned on me to look for the court evidence of what would be needed for in our ministry of apologetics, and these three just stood out, because as I sat here thinking, there is physical evidence, which I'm going to present to you. There's documentary evidence that I'm going to submit to you, that the Bible is accurate and all this stuff really took place. And there's testimonial evidence. We have all three of those. Thus, in a court case, if you could have all three of those, it's a slam dunk. I mean, that is it. That is so easy for the jury to go off and meet and very quickly form the verdict because they've got all three pieces of solid evidence, not just individual pieces, but lots of pieces is what we're going to see. So tonight, let's take a look at these three things, just briefly. I mean, trust me. Charlotte and my family knows I could go on starting on biblical archaeology and I could start talking now and still be talking when you guys leave. to go back up north. This is the thing. I've written two books on this. I love this kind of stuff. And let's take a look. And I'm just going to show you some new things. Now, I know some of you, including my wife, has sat through a lot of my archaeology things to the point that it's hard for her to stay awake through it because she's heard it so many times. But, I mean, that's true of anybody. If you sit there and listen to the same thing, right? I mean, if you watch the same movie over and over. I mean, I grew up having, or I had three daughters. Do you know how many times we had to watch, like, movies like Old Yeller? Or what's the one with the dog that runs away, Homeward Bound? Now, but you, well, you didn't. Heather did. Heather would put in Old Yeller, and as soon as it was over, Daddy, rewind it. We wore out so many rewind machines for those VHS and stuff. But, you know, and today if we sit down and watch these, I have a hard time staying awake, so I can understand that. So what I decided to do is do some new things that even she has not heard me talk on, and nor have I done too many presentations on this. Some of this is on our website, though. So poor Charlotte's going to hear a couple of things that she knows about, but there are some things here that's new that we're going to be doing videos on in the future. So let's start with physical evidence. Physical evidence supporting the Bible, that would be approved in any court case, and it's slam dunk that this is solid evidence. First of all, if you take a look, now I don't know if you brought your Bibles or if you're going to use your cell phone for your Bible or whatever, but one thing in Israel, and one of the first places I often take people when we go on tours is down south to a place called Beersheba. And at Beersheba, there is a replica sitting outdoors in this ancient town of an altar. There's a picture of it in your guide, and it's a horned altar. Now, to be totally honest with you, that's a replica. The original one is in a museum to get it out of the weather. And I have pictures of that too. I've got pictures of that one. It's a little darker in there. I chose this picture because I wanted to show it to you a little bit better in brighter colors and stuff. But it's an exact replica of what you see in there. So you notice that altar stands about, let's see, about this high. It's about this wide, like so. And notice that it has horns on it. Altars on many cultic things, and not just cultic things, some of the things of the Hebrews, they would put horns on altars. Now look what it says here as you're looking at this thing. In the book of Amos, chapter 3, verse 14, it says, I will punish the altars of Bethel, and the horns of the altar shall be cut off and fall to the ground. This is just one of many cases in the Bible describing Old Testament altars having horns. What archaeologists have found, and they keep finding, is they dig things up and they get the these altars, they find horns on the corners of them, just like you see here. There's many cases of these. What was the horn for? Well, one of the things we know, because the Bible tells us, that you could ask for sanctuary by grabbing hold of the horn. And that was like, you know, I'm claiming the altar for sanctuary, don't kill me. People have done that in some cases in the book of Kings and Chronicles, but that was one of the reasons for it. In other times, they would put a sacrifice, they would put blood on these. But the thing is, the point I'm trying to get across to you, the Bible talks about them having horns. What you do, see in Israel, altars with horns. Now, you might be thinking, Michael, that's a really insignificant little thing. But that's the point I'm trying to make. If the Bible is so precise on insignificant little details, how much more will it be on the others? If it's going to be screwed up, if there's going to be mistakes and stuff, wouldn't it make more sense that you would have the errors found in the little insignificant things? That would be the most logical thing. The major things like, well, is there a city of Jerusalem? We all know there is. That's a pretty big one. But horns on an altar, that's one, yeah. And we can see that beautiful thing there. Let's go to a second one. Another piece of evidence, Your Honor, that I submit to you, this will be Exhibit B, if you will. This is Solomonic gates. Now, Solomonic means having to do with King Solomon. In 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 15 through 17, I'm going to read this and listen carefully to what I'm reading, having to do with gates of a city. And this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house and the Milo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hatzor and Megiddo and Gezer. Those are all cities, by the way. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city and had given dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer and lower Beth-Horon. What did I just read? Solomon is rebuilding certain cities that are mentioned there. It talks about Gezer in particular, but we also know from other passages that he rebuilt the city of Megiddo, that he rebuilt, it mentions Jerusalem, that he built gates in Jerusalem. He's building gates. Now, for those of you who have not been to Israel, let me explain something to you. A gate is not a door. We today would think a gate is just the doorway. It's not the doorway. The gate was a large structure, like a fortress. The gate was. It had doors in it, but it also had rooms along the side. There'd be the main street going through it with doors, maybe at the front and at the back. But on the main street, there would be these empty rooms. Now, Canaanites, before the time of Solomon, built gates, these big forts, with primarily two rooms on each side. Solomon comes along and he improves on this and he puts in three. Now, you might be wondering, what are the rooms for? That's where business was done. You didn't go to the throne room to do businesses and stuff. You sat in these gates. If you recall in the book of Ruth, when Boaz is purchasing Ruth, where is he sitting? Where did he go to meet with the elders to make the transaction? The city gate. That's where kings would meet. That's where judges would meet and hear cases, was at the gate. But it was also a place you could put soldiers. So when the city is under attack, they got to come through the center. They have to go through all these rooms, which are just full of soldiers. So it was an advantage and protection is what it was, besides being a business aspect. We have on our video series, we have a thing on gates there in Israel. Solomon built three chambered gates. All archaeologists will agree with that. And I have given you pictures here of Gezer. And you can see, and it's being excavated even this summer some more there, that there is a three-gate system. There's a passageway down the center. You can easily see in the next picture, Megiddo, you can easily see a main street going through. There'd be doorways at the end there. Those buildings over on the sides, those are large walls. These gates were tall, and that would be holding where these rooms are. Or on the third picture I've given you is the Jerusalem complex, which has just been excavated in the last few years in the archaeological park that you find there. Now, how do we know these are Solomon? How do we know that just somebody didn't come along and build three gates? Here's one of the major clues. Archaeologists have measured these down to the centimeter, and they're all built on the same exact plan. In some cases, less than a centimeter difference in all of these things. That tells us it's the same person who is designing this. And we know from the Bible, Solomon was an architect. He designed a lot of things and built a lot of things. So, and pottery that is found there, coins and stuff that are found there, and other archaeological artifacts all point to the time period of Solomon being the person who did this. And it just so happens that the three places mentioned in the Bible that Solomon built these gates have that exact style of gate. Thus, these were actually Solomon's handiwork. And we have a great video on there on our website, especially about the Jerusalem one that we just filmed this past year. Let's go to another one. Submit to you. The Canaanite water shaft. David grew up in what city? Where was David from? Bethlehem. Bethlehem is only about 6 miles from Jerusalem. Now, when David was growing up, Jerusalem was not inhabited by Hebrews. If you go back and you read in the book of Judges and stuff, they couldn't conquer the Hebrew people. They did not conquer Jerusalem. And so it was Canaanites primarily living there. They called themselves, since they were from Jerusalem, they called themselves Jebusites. The Jebusites were living there. Now, David grew up just 6 miles from this Canaanite city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem sits on the side of a mountain. And the thing is, to have a city in ancient times, you need to have water. Jerusalem sits on an artesian spring coming up out of the ground, and it breaks through at a place called the Gihon Spring. It's on the eastern side of the city, about halfway up the mountain. It has fresh water. So good, clean water to this day still flows out of the Gihon Spring. So they have that spring. So there's water tunnels and stuff. The city of Jerusalem underneath has many tunnels and caves and things. But David says, now this is recording in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 8. David has now become king, and he's going to claim Jerusalem as the new capital. The capital had been Hebron, which is about 16 miles away. He wants to move it to Jerusalem. But the Jebusites don't want to give up their city. So David says, 2 Samuel 5, 8, and David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack these lame and blind who are hated by David's soul. Therefore, it is said the blind and lame cannot come in the house. They're making fun of David and calling him things and stuff like this. But David says specifically, when you're going to attack the city, go through the water shaft to get inside the city. The thing is, in the 1800s, this water shaft that you're seeing here, it's called Warren Shaft. You can see this. It's a vertical shaft going down, goes from outside the city. You can actually get access inside the city through that thing. And it's a natural cave tunnel. And then there's other parts that have been expanded as people built steps and stuff to get down in there. But that is, by most archaeologists, they believe this is the shaft, most likely that Joab and David's army went up to get inside the city to conquer the city. It's described in the Bible briefly, but there it is. Or let's take a look at the next one. Evidence D, Hezekiah's tunnel. A couple hundred years after David, we have good King Hezekiah. And it talks about that when Hezekiah was living, the Assyrians, very evil people, were coming from the east. That's where Nineveh was. Nineveh was one of the capitals. And they're coming over and they're going to attack King Hezekiah and the nation of Judah. Well, one way of conquering the city is to cut off the water supply. Just so happened, the water supply is outside the city walls of Jerusalem. It's not a good plan. Do you know it took hundreds of years for people to figure out to bring the water inside the city and not to have the wells outside the city? I mean, if you were designing a city, and you know at times you're going to have to defend your city, wouldn't it make sense to put the well inside the walls instead of on the outside? But that's how they did it for hundreds of years, so that shepherds and others could come up and use the well freely. Well, it was so dumb. The enemy can come up, capture your water supply, you're in trouble. So what are you going to do about it? Well, Hezekiah comes up with a plan. He says, the Gihon Spring, which was outside, I want you to dig a tunnel that's going to go through the solid rock. It's limestone. It's a soft limestone. And he says, I'm going to have you guys build this tunnel, and you can just barely walk through this. I'm sure your shoulders touched both sides of that as you walk through that. It is tight because it was just one man thick. They would take turns, we believe, using picks, and you can still see the pick marks all through there. And even sometimes there's a little chamber where they put a little oil lamp so they could see what they were doing. And they went through the city. It's about a quarter of a mile long. And I gave you a little map here from where the Gihon Spring is on the outside of the city wall. It zigzags its way around till it comes down to the Pool of Siloam. Now, here's what the Bible says about this. And in 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20, the rest of the deeds of Hezekiah and all his might and how he made the pool and the conduit, that's the tunnel, and brought water into the city. That passage there tells us that there is a thing, a tunnel Hezekiah made from the Gihon Spring, that's where the water was at, to bring it to the Pool of Siloam. That's there. And if you ever go to Israel, it's one of the most popular places to go to walk Hezekiah's tunnel. You get wet. How high was the water when you guys were in there? Okay. Pretty cold, though, when you first step in, isn't it? Because it's right out of the ground. That is artesian. That is cold water. It's clean. And that's what he did. And you keep going, and it comes out where the Pool of Siloam is. Again, we see that the Bible is extremely accurate. Here in one verse, we see that Hezekiah made a tunnel. Today, it's a major tourist attraction. Let's go to the next one that we have here. Let's go to E, Bethsaida. Now, this one's really interesting. I put this one in here for personal reasons, more or less. Jesus often talked about Bethsaida. Matthew 11:21, he says, woe to you, Bethsaida. If the miracles I had done for you were done in Sodom and Gomorrah. They would have repented long ago. In Mark chapter 8, verse 22, it reads, and they came to Bethsaida. Some of the people brought him a blind man and to beg him to touch him. So Jesus did miracles in this city. It's also the city where we are told from the Gospels that Peter, Andrew, and Philip were born. So if you have been going to Israel if you were there like 30, 40 years ago, they would take you to a place, they called it Bethsaida. It's the wrong place because it's a fishing village. Ancient historians describe this village. It was a little Jewish town, tiny little Jewish town, that Herod decided to make into a major Acropolis, a major city, Roman city. So they put in bathhouses, they have theaters and all this other stuff. And the place that normally is advertised, and if your parents ever went to Israel, the chances are they went to this place. It's called Et Tel. It's not the right place. Where a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Stephen Notley, he's been in the news a lot in the last 5 years. He and a couple of other professors have determined where the true city of Bethsaida is. As a matter of fact, there's a dig going on there. What month is this? We're in April now. So they're just finishing a little dig, or they're just starting it. Right about now, they're doing a little dig over there. But during the summer is when the big digs are. And he's been digging at this place. And the picture I've given you there is a recent picture. And what they have found is the remains of a Roman city right on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. We know that Bethsaida was a fishing village. The place I was telling you about that's not the place is 2 kilometers from the Sea of Galilee. That's an awful long ways to be a fishing village. To carry your boat and everything, that's a long way to haul. Where this is right on the side. Less than 50 yards from where this picture was taken is the Sea of Galilee. They have found Roman remains there, a bathhouse and other things. No Jews, Hebrew people, would not make a bathhouse. Public baths, no. Jews were very modest. They wouldn't go into a public bath like that. That's Roman. Also pottery there. They have found some broken pieces of architecture that seems to indicate that there was a synagogue there. Jewish historians tell us there was once a small little Jewish village that it was changed into a Roman. If there was a small little Jewish city, there would be a synagogue there first. And then it's this. This is called El Araj. It is in the news frequently. And you are seeing what I believe is the remains of El Araj or the city of Bethsaida. So that fits. F, our sixth piece of evidence I want to submit, is Hezekiah's broad wall. Now, I got to tell you this picture. I got a picture here for you. I took this my first year I ever went to Israel. I was walking along on a free day that we had to do some shopping in Jerusalem. And I was traveling with 2 women, and we were walking through the streets, and we came to a place, a little tiny hole-in-the-wall store that had tons of fabric. That's just what they sold. Was fabric, bolts of fabric, and they had weavers, looms in there and stuff, and they had threads and stuff, and these 2 ladies just went nuts. Oh my gosh, fabric store. And so they ran in there, and they said, we'll only be a minute. Yeah, I was like half hour later they came out. But I'm like standing outside. I went in for a second, and I was like, this is just, I mean, it's so small and everything. It's like about the size of one of your rooms here. It's not very big. And I can't believe to this day how they spent so much time in there. But anyway, I came out, and I'm standing outside the store, and I'm just, you know, people walking by, I'm watching people, and like there's not really much around, but there's a railed fence right in front of me. So after a while, I walk over to the rail fence, and I look down, and that is the image that I get. I saw that, and I'm thinking, okay, that's an ancient wall. So I'm standing there. I had time, so I started just standing there studying this wall. Archaeologists were digging there. When you guys were there this past year, that was all covered up. We couldn't see it. But here, this is what it looks like underneath that. And they've done more digging around this. But this is this wall. It's right in the middle of Jerusalem. And just in the most odd place. It's a very broad, very thick wall. And as I'm standing here looking at this, I noticed something down at the bottom. I tried to do this as the picture as best I can for the size. But it shows the wall going, say this table is the wall. You can see the remains of houses where the rooms of houses went at an angle into this. In other words, there were houses there first, and then somebody came along, told the people, get out of the houses, we're going to build a wall here. So they broke the houses down to the foundation stones and stuff, and they used those stones to help build this massive wall. And as I'm standing there looking at that, all of a sudden it dawned on me, back in Isaiah chapter 22, Hezekiah, for fear of the Assyrians coming and that they're going to conquer Jerusalem, because they say they're going to, in Isaiah chapter 22, who's a contemporary of Hezekiah, he wrote, "And you counted the houses of Jerusalem, and you broke down the houses to fortify the wall." I'm standing there, that verse comes to my mind, and I'm like, holy cow, this shows houses that were broken down to build this big, massive wall. Pottery and coins and stuff that have been found there dated back to King Hezekiah and to the time of Isaiah. And Isaiah is saying, you broke down the houses to fortify a wall. It's exactly what you see in the Bible. We have a little clip on that there on our website also. So that's that type of evidence. Let's go to documentary evidence. Documentary evidence, things were written. Now, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. We had the Engedi scroll. I'm going to save you time since we already talked about that. How they found that little burnt piece that looked like of wood, but that was actually the book of Leviticus. But just to give you an idea what I'm talking about, it's an old scroll. We have scrolls like that. Well, this is something, I think we have this on the website, don't we, Charlotte? The Ketef Himnon, we have that on there. Okay. I remember shooting that, but I couldn't remember if we have it on the website. We've got a lot of things we haven't got on the website yet. Okay. What happened here? In the Himnon Valley, it's on the west side of the old city of Jerusalem. This is where they sacrificed people. Children sacrificed were there. They burned people there. It was a place of a lot of pagan stuff like this. But there are graves there. And not that long ago, an archaeologist was digging there. He actually invited a school group to help him come and dig. And you can see, I mean, it's exposed. Watch our video on this. You can see where they laid bodies on these ancient tombs. Now, what they would do when a person died, they would, just like we talked about with Jesus, they put him on a stone slab. You know, they wrap him up and put him there. And then afterwards, a year later, this is, sounds sort of gruesome to us today in our culture, but what the Jews would do, they'd leave the body all wrapped up for a year, seal up the tomb. A year later, you come back and you unwrap Uncle Joe and you take his bones, and then you would put his bones into a place. They would just dump the bones into a, like a receptacle back in the Old Testament days. Just a chamber, they would throw the bones in there. That's why it says, if you ever read the Bible, it says he slept with his fathers, referring to somebody being dead, because it would be a family tomb. They would take his bones and put him in with the rest of the family. That's why it says they slept with their father. It's a reference to being dead and their bones being put in there. Now, they're working on this tomb. This tomb, It's open. You can see inside the tomb. There's nothing in there, really. But this archaeologist, Gabriel Barkei, was the guy who was doing this. And he didn't expect to find anything. But he went in there with some volunteers from a school. And there was a boy who was driving him nuts. And he lets this boy go inside there to get him out of the way, to go clean the thing. The boy knew he was being punished because he was always getting into trouble. And so he took a hammer into the thing, sat down on the floor. There's nothing in the tomb. It's just an empty stone room, just a box with a small little opening. And he sits in there and he just starts banging the floor. Why guys do that, I don't know. This is a middle school child, and he's just banging away with a hammer on the floor. He knew he was in trouble. All of a sudden, the floor gave way. It was a false floor. See, he falls about 8 feet down. It's like an Indiana Jones movie here. He falls down, and when the dust cleared, he had landed in the receptacle of all the bones of that family. So there's skulls, femurs, rib bones, and everything. When the dust clears, he's looking, and he's sitting in a mass of this. So he's screaming bloody murder. Everybody goes running over. They pull him out of there, and they find out, oh, my gosh, this was a false floor. No one knew that this was down there. And they found all sorts of things from the tomb. This family put in a false floor to hide all the valuables because they buried jewelry, coins, all sorts of stuff down there with them. Pottery, all sorts of things. But what they also found were two small little scrolls made of silver, not animal skin, silver. We commonly call them the silver scroll. You can go to Google and just type in silver scrolls, it'll come up. Each one of them made of silver, and they have an inscription made with something pointy, like something, maybe like a nail or something. But on this is what it read. Now, these things, I should tell you, too, date back to the time of King Hezekiah, right around that range. So this is 800 years or so, 700 years before Christ. To give you an idea, we're still in the books of Kings and Chronicles. But this is what it says when you decipher it. It reads, "May the Lord bless you and guard you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his face unto you and give you peace." You ever heard that passage before? Did it sound familiar? Do you see how accurate your Bible is? And these are actual scrolls that have been found. They also had not, that was out of Leviticus. There's also passages of Deuteronomy inscribed on them. But they found them. So we have actually old scrolls back from the Old Testament that have that. It's an amazing discovery. All right, let's go to our next one here. C of evidence, documentary evidence. This is new. This was just in the news for a couple of years ago as a discovery. Back in the book of Judges, when you have all these different judges before Israel has kings, there was one, you're all going to be familiar with the name. His name is Gideon. If you know the story of Gideon in chapter 6, verse 32 of the book of Judges, Gideon chopped up one of the altars, the idols that the people of the village were worshiping and stuff. He went out there, broke it up at nighttime and stuff like this. But then people got upset with, well, who did this? And they're trying to find out who it was. It was Gideon. You can read the story. It's in chapter 6 of the book of Judges. But this is what happens when they find out that Gideon did it. Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal, that is to say, let Baal contend against him. And he broke down his altar. Gideon had a nickname. You find it in the Bible. Jerubbaal. That's his name. Just a few years ago, in 2019, they were digging, and they came across that broken piece of pottery that you see there. I've given you the actual photograph with a ruler thing underneath it, and then a drawing of it to let you see a little bit more closely. But what is fascinating about it, the Proto-Hebrew writing on that says Jerubbaal. We now have found a piece of pottery, many scholars believe, had Gideon's name on it. Many times you would put your name on pottery. That wasn't unheard of. People today write their names on coffee stuff. So, but they found that in 2019. Guess how old it is? It dates back to the time of Gideon, about 1100 BC, during the period of the judges, in other words, give or take 100 years, but it's right in there, right around when Gideon lived. How cool is that? I bet you didn't even know that they had found this. This didn't make world news tonight, let me tell you, but that's an amazing discovery, and it's still being talked about a lot, because like I say, they found this, but they didn't publish it right away. It was just published a couple of years ago, but that was another one. Here's another piece of documented evidence. This is a scarab. What's labeled D is a scarab of one of the pharaohs of Egypt. Now, pharaohs of Egypt often had animals to represent who they were, besides little hieroglyphics to signify what their names were. This one here has the name and the symbol of Amenhotep II. Big deal. It's just a little scarab, a stamp, if you will. But that's what it is. They found it at a town. Its modern name is El Makatir. Many archaeologists believe that this is the ancient city of Ai, spelled A-I, the city that Joshua conquered after Jericho, where they first suffered a defeat. Joshua comes back with the army and slaughters the inhabitants and burns the city. One of only three cities Joshua burned. And they slaughtered the inheritance because they had defeated the Hebrew in a battle, because the Hebrew had sinned. That's why. And they have found in this ash layer, it's being studied right now. There's archaeologists this summer going back over there and digging things out. This was found not that long ago. And what they found on this is the name of Amenhotep II. That's his signature, basically, his image that he used for his name and stuff. So this is the pharaoh that I believe is the pharaoh of Exodus. Now, if you want to know why I believe it's the pharaoh of Exodus, you can go to our website. We have a very popular, I mean, it's that one's really popular, isn't it? The pharaoh of the Exodus. I have it's like 45 minutes or so of a lesson on our website. You can pull it up and you can read, and it comes out. I do believe there is a tremendous amount of evidence that it was Pharaoh Amenhotep. Now, the thing is, he was ruling Egypt. Egypt had already come over and was ruling in a lot of cities in Canaan. This was one of the cities that he had a representative. Thus, it makes perfect sense that a scarab for him would be found there by the time of Joshua coming in, because the Exodus is now over, that you would find the scarab of Amenhotep II. And it's found in an ash layer, which shows the city was burned, and the pottery and stuff dates right back to when the Bible says about 1400 BC. It all fits perfectly. So the Amenhotep scarab is what that one's called. Let's go to another one. The Stele of Hophra. In Jeremiah chapter 44, God mentions a pharaoh by the name of Hophra. And it reads in chapter 44, verse 30, thus says the Lord, behold, I will give Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hands of his enemies and into the hand of those who seek his life, as I gave Zedekiah, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, who was his enemy. The Bible is mentioning in more than one place, this is just one, of a pharaoh at the time of the Babylonians ruling Egypt, whose name was Hophra. Now, what they found was this stela. You can see this. This was found just 2 years ago, well, 3 years ago now, in 2021, a farmer was working his field, cultivating, plowing things up, and he hit this big rock, and he started digging the dirt away, and he found this huge stela. It's just a large monument, but it's all Egyptian writing on it and stuff like this, and so it's like, really, this is interesting. And so as he digs this thing up, archaeologists come in, they start looking at it, they're reading it, and it's mentioning a pharaoh on here in Egyptian language, Wahibre, that is the Egyptian pharaoh, but the Hebrew called him Hophra. Thus, the pharaoh who is mentioned here in the book of Jeremiah has been confirmed that is a real guy who lived, because this was found by a farmer just a couple of years ago. This field is just amazing. Hophra was the pharaoh who was killed, who King Hezekiah, if you know the story about Hezekiah trying to, King Zedekiah trying to rebel against the Babylonians, he made the Bible tells us that he made a pact, an alliance with Hophra to fight against the Babylonians. And this thing actually is talking about that. And Hophra, for his part to a break, he was trying to break Nebuchadnezzar.
This break is brought to you by the Marine Biology Trip, an evidence for faith adventure in science and the Bible in the Florida Keys for ages 14 and up. Here's what a past student had to say.
Well, I've definitely grown in my knowledge on marine biology. I came here and I knew nothing, and I finished through this, and I feel like I learned a lot. And I also feel like I grew a lot in my faith and spiritually, because it has taught me how the Bible works. It's something that you'll never get somewhere else. Here is a place that I have felt very at home. The group is very inclusive, and all the people you meet here are going to be lifelong friends.
Find out more about this adventure by clicking the link in the description or go to evidenceforfaith.org/marinebiology. That's evidence4faith.org/marinebiology.